Good morning. It's good to see everyone. Everyone looks well. I feel like it was a really long weekend. For those of you who have your Bible, go ahead and turn to Ephesians chapter 4. And if you've been here for the last few weeks, you know that we're going through a series in the Ten Commandments. If you haven't, we're doing a series in the Ten Commandments where we're looking at each commandment that God gives. And some of them are a little bit more straightforward than others. Today we're talking about stealing, and hopefully stealing's relatively a straightforward moral proposition for most of us. You know, hopefully most of us have learned along the way somewhere from parents, from school, from just our own consciences that it's not good to steal. Unfortunately, that doesn't mean that we don't steal. One of my early vivid memories is I think when I was about 7 or 8 years old, I was over at a friend's house in the neighborhood, and we were playing Legos, and he had a couple Lego pieces that I didn't have. And so when he wasn't looking, I snuck them into my jeans and went home. I would like to say that's the only time I've ever stolen something. It's not, but just to rest your conscience, I haven't done it lately, so you don't have to worry about that. You know, stealing is one of the things that comes up in the Ten Commandments, and for the most part, we take not just this commandment, but we take the commandments usually through this lens of individual moralism, and that's one way that we can look at it. For instance, you know, when it comes to commandment number 8, you shall not steal. Typically, the way we approach it is we sit our kids down when they're young or when something has happened, and we say, "Don't steal." That's what bad people do, and you don't want to be a bad person, right? And that's a very kind of moralistic approach to the commandment. I think another way that we tend to deal with it is we say to them, we say, you know, don't steal because God says not to, and if you do it, then God won't love you. God won't be pleased with that. And again, that's a very moralistic approach, and we could do that. You know, we could jump into it, and we could kind of deal with it from a very moralistic point of view, and in some way, that's somewhat effective, right? You can scare someone, you can tell someone, and it can be convicting. But what we've been trying to do through the series is we've been trying to take a more holistic approach. Rather than taking this moralistic approach of simply don't steal because, you know, reason 1, reason 2, reason 3, we've been trying to take kind of a broader picture and a more holistic approach to why these commandments are important, why each one means something, and how it deals with more than what we think it deals with. Because sometimes not in our moralism, we're simplistic. And that's kind of what happens today is we look at this commandment against stealing, and the commandment's very, very straightforward. If you go to Exodus 20, it's simply, you shall not steal. It seems very, very straightforward, but there's a little bit more to it. And so like we've been doing the last couple of weeks, or through the series actually, we've been looking at case studies. And the case study that we're looking at today is Ephesians chapter 4, which, if you notice, stealing comes up in the middle, but it doesn't come up the way that we expect it to. It comes up in a little different context in a little different way. And so as we look at it holistically through Ephesians 4, we're going to see 3 things. First, we're going to see the setting of the commandment. We're going to see the setting of community, because what Ephesians does is it places the commandment within the realm of community. So the first thing we're going to see is the setting of community. Second, the foundation for community. And then the sign of community. Okay, so first the setting of community, the foundation for community, and then the sign of community. Okay, so first we see the setting of community. If you go to verse 25, you start reading from there. And Paul says this. He says, "Therefore, having put away falsehood, let each one of you speak the truth with his neighbor, for we are members one of another. Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger, and give no opportunity to the devil. Let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor doing honest work with his own hands, so that he may have something to share with anyone in need." Now, what I want you to notice is Paul immediately takes this idea of stealing, and he puts it into the setting, into the context of community, which is a very interesting thing to do. He's not talking about individual moralism. He's not talking about simply, you know, this commandment in terms of stark moral terms. He brings it up in the midst of this discussion on community. And if you remember, that's kind of what's happening in Ephesians 4. Now, Paul writes the letter to the Ephesians, and the church in Ephesus is a church that's divided. You know, on one side, you have Jewish Christians, you know, Christians who, before they became believers, were Jewish, Jewish heritage, Jewish beliefs, and they came to believe in Jesus to be the Messiah. And then you have another portion of the church who are Gentile Christians who don't have that Jewish background. And there's this clash of cultures. And so in the letter to the Ephesians, one of Paul's main thrusts is how the gospel actually makes them one. He says that they have one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God, one Father of all. And then right before we get to this section, he talks about how God has given them different gifts. And in these different giftings, these different gifts build up the body. And as the body is built up, they attain unity. So essentially what Paul is talking about is he's talking about community. He's talking about the church body. He's talking about the fact that the gospel makes this these disparate groups of people one. You know, one people who love one another, who have the same commitments, the same desires, the same loves, the same future, the same hopes. And in the midst of talking about community, if you notice verse 25, he switches gears and he says, let me show you what community looks like. Here's what you have to be thoughtful of. Here's what you need to be wary of. What Paul does is in the middle of that section that we read, he brings up stealing. And again, it's strange because we don't think of stealing as a community issue, right? We don't think about it, but we don't think about it as something that, you know, that affects our neighborhood. In terms of the people who live next to us or our church community, something that kind of happens kind of out there with businesses and cities and things like that. It's this, and the problem is this is individual moral issue. And again, what Paul does is he pulls it into the realm of community. And you know, what's interesting is, you know, from ancient times, even through modern times, up until about the 50s, the context of stealing was always community. Right? If you think about the Greek and Roman societies, if you think about Jewish societies, communities were groups of people who were connected. They were connected by heritage, by upbringing. They were connected by family, by faith. And so to steal was to steal from someone that you knew. It was to steal from a neighbor, a friend, a relative, a spiritual brother or sister, regardless of what that religion is. I think even in modern day, you know, when you get up to about the 50s, you didn't have a lot of nameless, faceless corporations and businesses. It was stores that were owned by families, people who lived in your neighborhood, people that your kids went to school with. And so the idea of stealing, always in the context of community. You know, stealing meant that you were taking from someone that you knew, someone that you were supposed to care about, someone who mattered to you, someone who you saw regularly, someone who you interacted with, someone who, again, might even be a family member in a distant way or a close way, someone who might attend the same synagogue, the same church as you. It hasn't been until the last 50, 60, 70 years that it's kind of become depersonalized. You know, that you can go out and you can steal from a business and it's nameless, it's faceless. But before then, stealing was always community. It was always about community. It was about taking from someone else and enriching yourself. There was always a communal aspect to it. You know, you were always hurting people that you were connected to somehow. And in a very societal way, you know, in a very ancient way, that meant that ultimately you were also hurting yourself. That even though you might be enriching yourself, you were ruining the community that you live in. You were hurting people that you love. And that was problematic. And that's one of the reasons why Paul brings it up here. And that means that if if stealing does have its context in community, it means that stealing is one of those things that, like Paul mentions with all these other things, it's one of the things that corrodes, that inhibits, that damages the strength of a community. And again, we don't function exactly like that, but it's interesting that it has that connection to community and to, you know, the life that we live among others in the world. But that's where we start. We see the setting of community. I think the second thing we see is we see the foundation of community. We go to verse 28, we look at the verse itself that talks about stealing. And what Paul says is this. He says, "Let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor doing honest work with his own hands, so that he may have something to share with anyone in need." Now, if you go back and, you know, we read from verse 25. If you go from 25 down to 32, they're all about different things that are harmful to the community. So you can start at the beginning. He says, put away falsehoods. For your members, be angry, do not sin. It talks about relationships. And then he brings up this idea of stealing. And what's interesting about stealing is he doesn't just say, you know, don't steal. He says, let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor doing honest work. You know, what's interesting to me is the Bible here kind of affirms the fact that there is a value to work. You know, that work is an important part of our lives, an important part of what we do, what we should be doing. It also reminds us that there is a sense in which work is meant to fulfill us. It's meant to be something that we do not just for the money it provides us to take care of our family. It's also something that plays into the community. And in the context of community, you know, he says, or is it verse 28? He says, let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor doing honest work. Well, if you think about that, what is stealing then? Well, it's dishonest work. It's the opposite of honest labor. It's dishonest labor, right? It's dishonest work. And so it's interesting, if you take it that way, then there's something very dishonest, very untrustworthy about stealing. And that's, again, that's not a huge surprise. That's not something that shocks people. But it's important in this sense. In the context of community, it's important, right? Stealing is a lifestyle of dishonesty. It's untrustworthiness. And the reason why that's important is because ultimately what it does is it strikes at the heart of what community needs. And then one of the things that community needs in order to thrive is it needs a level of trust, level of honesty, a level of integrity. You know, that without trust, there's very little sense in which we can be a community. Right? Community is this idea of living life together, you know, living your life closely connected with a group of people. And in order to do that in a way that it's fully functioning and flourishing, there needs to be a level of honesty and integrity and trust, or else you don't want to be a part of that community, right? If you join a group, if you join a community and you find out that they're all being deceptive or they're doing things that lack integrity, right? They're talking behind your back and yet when they're with you, they're saying these nice flowery things, then you realize you can't exist in that. There's very little hope for that. Right? When the trust isn't there, then you begin to feel as if nothing is ever going to happen, that nothing will ever get farther. And you know, in a very real way, Paul is talking about community, and this is one of the things he places as a building block. And he talks about this idea of stealing because stealing has to deal with this idea of trust and integrity. Right? If you move into, you know, into a neighborhood and all of a sudden you find out that your neighbor is breaking into your house, taking your stuff, you don't want to live there anymore. It's simple. You don't want to see that person anymore. You don't want to talk to them anymore. You want nothing to do with them. And that's kind of the stark picture. You know, in a lot of smaller ways, I mean, there's ways in which we break trust. There's ways in which we can disrupt the trust of a community by not being honest, by not being people of integrity. But stealing has that effect. You know, it breaks trust. It damages and it destroys the ability to have community. You know, one of the things that kind of jumped out to me when I was reading through this and studying through it is when you read through the list of all these things that Paul says, now, you know, as a community, these are things you should be doing. And again, you can go through the list. He says, put away falsehood, be angry, but do not sin, don't steal, let no corrupting talk come out of your mouth. You know, all these different things. Like, the thing that struck me again and again is community is really fragile. You know, it's really, really easy to break. It's really easy to destroy. You know, sometimes it's purposeful things, but sometimes it's accidental things. It's an unkind word at just at the wrong time. But it's a reminder of how delicate community is in some ways, about how fragile it can be. About how dangerous it is, and how there needs to be this structure of trust, of honesty, of integrity. I think the third thing that I wanted to look at is he talks about this idea of a sign, and this is the most profound part of this. He talks about a sign of community. In other words, I think one of the things that happens a lot is we look for places. You know, one of the things that happens a lot in our culture today is people go to church to find community. People go to certain groups to look for community. I think usually when people come and visit churches, that's the first thing I think is, and that's usually what they first say, is they say, oh, you know, I'm looking for a place for a community, for, you know, a group that I can belong to, that I can feel comfortable with, and, you know, they'll say a couple things after that. But the question is this, like, how do you know when you find it? Right? How do you know when you really find it? How do you know when you're with people and you're meeting them for the first time and you start to spend time with them? Like, how do you know that you actually have community? How do you know that these are good people and that it's worth putting the time in? How do you know when you're at the point where you're finally kind of committed and you're kind of ready to go? And verse 28 is actually really profound about that. You know, it doesn't just say don't steal because that breaks society, that breaks community, teeters things, you know, because of trust issues. It also shows us this really profound sense of when you know that you have community or how you can build it. And so verse 28, he says this. He says, let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor, doing honest work with his own hands so that he may have something to share with anyone in need. Now, again, as we talked about, there's this contrast. He talks about dishonest work versus honest work. There is dishonest work, which is a life of stealing and taking, versus honest work. And then right after that, he says, here's the reason why you should work, right? Here's the reason why you should labor. Here's the reason why you should do honest work. And this is the profound part. Verse 28, he says, let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor, doing honest work with his own hands, so that. Right? This is the purpose. He says, you should do work, you should work hard, so that, and this is one of the reasons why we should work, he says, so that he may have something to share with anyone in need. Now, what he says is this. He says, as a member of the community, you should work hard, you should labor so that, right, in order to, you know, it's a purpose statement, so that when others are in need, you can give to them. And, you know, what we see here in a really profound way is the sign of community is giving. It's generosity. It's helping. Let me see if I can explain it. I'll first use kind of the analogy of friends. Most of us realize there's a difference between friends and acquaintances. You know, those are two different categories that we use in our modern parlance. When we transition to high school, when we transition into college, when you leave college and you start working in a new city, new place, you switch jobs, you know, there's all these situations where we end up in new places, new neighborhood, you know, all these different things. A lot of times the first thing that happens is we start looking for people. We start looking for friends, right? We get to high school and we walk into the cafeteria and we know no one, right? There's, who do I sit next to? What do I do? We go to college, you know, we're living, we move our stuff in, and the first thing we do is we start looking for people. Who am I going to eat with? Who am I going to spend time with? We start working somewhere. We move to a new city. We start working, and that's one of the first, who am I going to spend my time with? How am I going to spend my weekends? And so the first thing we do is we start looking for friends. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, we start kind of engaging in small talk. We say hi, we get into these conversations, and little by little, we move to kind of eating together, you know, sitting next to each other while we're eating lunch, or, you know, talking about our boss, you know, how much we dislike our boss and kind of bonding over those things. And then little by little, we start spending time with people outside of work, outside of class, outside of, you know, the things that are normal. And in the beginning stages, if you think about it very honestly, I mean, all those efforts of friendship building are self-serving, right? They're self-serving, right? It's because in high school, I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to sit down by myself at my own table with no one, you know, with no one to talk to. And we move into a new area, you know, I don't want to sit in my house and do nothing and not have any relationships. And in the beginning, it's absolutely self-serving. We want someone to spend time with. We want someone to talk to. We want someone to fill, you know, parts of our lives. And over time, if things go well, they become friends. And the way that you tell, the way that you notice is your relationship is no longer self-serving in that way. You begin to stretch. You begin to do things that aren't for your benefit. You start doing things that sometimes can be inconvenient for you, sometimes sacrificial. And that's when you know that someone is becoming a friend. That's when you know that you move them from the pile of acquaintances to the pile that you call friends. And you know, that's a huge jump. Because previously, the only question you have is, how can this person serve me? How do they help me? And if they stop helping me, then they're done. I don't need to spend time with someone who takes up so much of my energy, who takes up so much of my time, right, in that stage. But if they're a friend, if they're going through a season where they need to talk and spew, then you're okay with them taking up your energy and taking up your time, right? Because it's not about you anymore. Their relationship isn't solely self-serving. That something has shifted, that something has changed. And you know, it's the same thing for them. You can tell when someone thinks you're a friend when they're willing to give, genuinely give to you. Not out of a social obligation or not out of a sense of guilt, but simply because they care. They do things that are inconvenient, that are sacrificial, and it dawns on you that they consider you a friend. And you know, this context of giving and generosity, that's not just how you know that someone's a friend, it's also how you know that you found community. You know, because up until then, the question is always, what can I get? What can I take? What can I glean? What can I benefit from? And until then, you always sit just on the outside, just on the periphery, because you're not willing to push your chips into the table. You're not willing to take the risks. You're not willing to open yourself up. You always sit on the outside, protected and safe, but alone. And you see, the moment that changes, It isn't when you've been there long enough and all of a sudden, you know, someone says something. You know, the way that you know that you've found community and the way that you know you're ready for community is you begin to give. You begin to open up, and it's not about what you can get anymore. It's not about what people can offer you. It's not how they can fill the loneliness in your life and in your time. But all of a sudden, you begin to turn and say, how can I help? How can I give? How can I serve? How can I love? You know, it's an incredibly important dynamic. You know, just as a pastor, one of the things that I got into a conversation with my friend when I was at the retreat, and we were talking about church membership for some of you. You know, with the guys I went to seminary with, when I meet up with them, sometimes we just talk about life and fun. Other times we talk about these weird theological things. Other times we talk about church stuff. And so we got on this thing about church, and we were just joking about how for some people it takes them so long to decide to become members of a church, right? That someone can come and they start attending, and they can be there for years and years and years and years and years and attend all these different things and never, you know, never have a desire to become a member. And then all of a sudden, after like 5 years and 37 days, they say, you know, Pastor, I want to become a member, right? And so whenever that happens, when I was younger, I'd get surprised and I think, I wonder what changed. Right? And in my mind, I go, well, I mean, it doesn't seem really different from year 4 to year 5. I mean, it seems like they were still, you know, nothing really major happened. They were a part of the same things. The relationships are about the same from then to here. And when I was younger, I always wondered, like, what changed? Like, what made this person say, okay, now I want to be a member? And I don't remember when it happened, but years ago, what struck me was this. I think typically, like the tipping point for people when they say, I want to become a member, it's this point where they say, you know what? What can I give to this church? What can I give to this community? Right? They spend all those years saying, how does this church fit me? How does it help me? How does it help my parenting? How does it help my marriage? How does it help me understand God? How does it help me grow? How does it help me change? But you see, the church becomes a community to them when they finally start saying, what can I give? And you see, that one little change actually changes everything. Because again, until that happens, you're always sitting on the edges. And as you're sitting on the edges, not only are you protected, you're always waiting for that moment where that thing is finally going to happen where you say, yeah, see, I knew it. I can't be here. I can't trust these people. I don't belong here. See, up until that point where you start to give, there's always suspicion. There's always fear. And there's always kind of one foot out the door ready to go. But you know that a group of people is a true community when they start to give and when you start to give. You realize it's the right place when people aren't using you, where you aren't a number to them, you aren't a thing to them, you aren't something that fills a need for them. You begin to realize that they simply give. And you begin to realize that this is your community when you begin to want to give back to them. That's incredibly profound. And you see, what that means is it means that this shift from just being a group of people to being a community is a shift from what can I get, what can I take, to what can I give. And you see, the reason why Paul puts that puts stealing into that context is because stealing is indicative of an attitude of taking. What can I receive? What benefit can I glean? What can I have? And that because of that, it's destructive, not just to the society, not just to the community, but to the soul too. And once that change starts to happen, once you begin to say, what can I give? You know, giving, generosity, all of that is the anti-stealing. Right, it's giving and generosity is saying, you know what, I'm no longer going to rob others. I'm no longer going to take what they offer and grab it for myself. I'm going to take what I have and I'm going to rob myself and give it to others around me. And you see, when you start saying that, when you start feeling that, when you start acting like that, then it's different. And what you find is friendship. What you find is community. What you find is fellowship. And you know, that completely makes sense because the gospel is about community. You know, ultimately, what the gospel is about is it's about how Jesus stole from himself. He robbed himself to enrich others. You know, that when Jesus went to the cross, it wasn't about what he could take. It wasn't about what he could accumulate, what he could, how he could benefit, what he could receive. It was about what he could give. And you know, when you understand that, if you're a Christian, when you understand that, you no longer feel an anger towards God. You no longer feel that God is this demanding God who's always asking for things, always wanting things, always saying, I have to have this, you have to be like that. When you understand that Jesus on the cross was not taking but rather giving, then you begin to understand the gospel for what it is, that Jesus came to give his life for you. You know, for those of you who aren't believers, when you realize that Jesus came to die to give you and not to take from you, then it's one more proof that Jesus really does love you, that it isn't a scam, that he's not trying to fool you. It's not spiritual Monty where he switches the cards out on you and all of a sudden you're stuck with this load of morality that you didn't want in the beginning. When you realize that Jesus came to give and not to take, and you realize that he is the one who truly loves and that you can give your heart to him. Let's pray. Father, we thank you that, again, in a very important, very necessary way, and you remind us of the community that Jesus provides for us. Through his living, through his suffering, through his dying, that in Jesus we find, in his death we find the redemption, the restoration that makes us community, that makes us people who have common cause, same hopes, same future, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God, one Lord, and that in Jesus wanting to give his life rather than take from ours, we also find our reason to be people who give, to be a community of givers. And we find a reason to feel safe and protected here. Because we aren't out to steal from one another, to take from each other, but Lord, simply to give generously from all that we have, because that's what Jesus has done for us. And Lord, I pray that we walk away with that sense of joy, knowing that we have a God who is constantly giving the things we need, the things we want, the things that will ultimately transform us, and that we have it because in Jesus Christ he came to give his life as a ransom for many, that many should receive. We pray all this in his name. Amen.